وعلى آله وأصحابه أجمعين، ولا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم. سبحانك اللهم لا علم لنا إلا ما علمتنا إنك أنت العليم الحكيم. So in recent weeks and for quite a while now we've been going through the Risala of Ibn Abi Zayd al-Qayrawani, and we're actually now in lesson 29, so we've come through quite a ways so far. The last 2 weeks we've been going through the bab that deals with zakah. So 2 weeks ago we were talking about the zakat on harf, on crops. Last week it was the zakat on ayn, which is gold and silver, and they're equivalent if you take that position, although if you look strictly, the strict position is that it's just gold and silver. Bruce didn't have a zakat. But moving on now, we're going to talk about two other things today. We talked also about mines, the zakat on mines, which is slightly separate from the zakat on gold and silver, even though by mines, they simply mean gold mines and silver mines, not diamond mines or anything like that. So today we're going to talk about jizya, which, although it's not really zakat, it's considered to be connected because it is what the non-Muslims living under the Muslims would pay. So they realized that by the time of Malik and these books of fiqh that we have, that countries were not only Muslims living in them. There were quite a few non-Muslims, especially in the early days. Even countries like Syria and Egypt probably had a majority of people who were not Muslim living in those countries in the early days. So, and in fact, most of Egypt was taken on watan, by force, which means that a lot of the lands of Egypt cannot actually be sold. Although with the passage of time, a lot of those things change because of people, you know, leaders going beyond what was allowed and giving concessions to people and so on and so forth. But anyway, that was the original law. So there's actually two types of land when it comes to non-Muslims, or three types. There's land that was taken, what's called unwatan, which is by force. Where the Muslims come in, they often would give, you know, they would tell the people either pay jizya or come into Islam. And then the people refuse, so the Muslims would attack them. And then that's considered to be land now that's been taken on watan, because they did not accept the Muslims' terms. The other one is when the Muslims offered these terms to people, they would say either pay jizya or become Muslim. The people said, okay, we'll take the option of paying jizya. That's called sulh. And that's another type of land that used to be under the control of the Muslims. Then you have what's called Dar al-Harb, which is the lands outside the Muslim control. And this was also divided up into different categories. There'd be Dar al-Harb where they had no uhda or no ahd with the Muslims of any sort. And that was considered to be an ongoing war. People from that were fair game in a sense. Although they often came in, traders often came in from those places, and that will be dealt with. And then there were people who had an ahd with the Muslims. This ahd could be to pay jizya. It could be for a tribute, say 1,000 dinars a year from that place, or it could be without a tribute. Sometimes, you know, the Muslims would simply think it was in the interests of Islam basically to have a treaty with these people so they could concentrate somewhere else. And this is not a permanent thing like the dhimma status is. So the lands that were under the Muslims, they were permanently safe, the non-Muslims. Those who were outside the lands of Islam were temporarily safe or not safe at all. So these are the different categories. So what the Muslims would take from people who were non-Muslim was called the jizya. And this was divided up into jizya unwiya, which is taken from the lands that are taken by force. And that's the official number that's mentioned here. So it had a specific number attached to it. And that was either for on the heads of people, in other words, per person, and we're going to talk about what people had to pay it, or kharaj, which is on their land. They were the two types. When it was by surah, the amount that a non-Muslim had to pay was not set. It was set by the surah, by the mediation or the agreement that the Muslims made with them. So it could be for less or it could be for more. Usually it was for less. And then we're going to come to something else, which is the trading thing, which was paid by people outside of Islam when they entered the lands of Islam. So those are the different types of monies that came in. And I mentioned the other one, which was tribute, which is separate. So one of the trading one, which we'll come to, is probably very similar to what's called tariffs now. which is very much in the news. He says he وتؤخذ الجزية من رجال أهل الذمة الأحرار البالغين. So the jizya is taken from one category of non-Muslim, and that is men who are free. Because in those days, people were divided up into those who are ahrar and those who are abid, those who were free and those who were slaves. Slaves had slightly different categories in Islam, but the free people, they were, when it comes to zakat, slaves don't have to pay zakat. So similar to that, when it comes to jizya, slaves were exempt from jizya. When it comes to zakat, though, children have to pay zakat according to Malik. And that's different from Abu Hanifa, that children don't have to pay zakat. Imam Malik considered that children have to pay zakat because of the statement of Aisha radiallahu anha, that she said, you have to invest the money of orphans to make sure it doesn't get eaten by zakat. So if children didn't have to pay zakat, how would their money get eaten by zakat? Wouldn't make sense. So that's the position of Malik when it comes to children. And women have to pay zakat. But jizya, only men. Women do not pay any jizya. Only the men. And there are other things attached to it. They have to have the ability to pay, as he's going to come to. If they don't have the ability to pay, then either they pay less what they can pay, or they don't pay anything at all. It was quite easy in that regard. And they have to be living in the place where other people of their background are living. If they're on their own, like they were in a monastery and only, you know, they're separated from the people, or a hermitage, they don't pay jizya. So there are lots of different things that stop a person. And if they were a slave that was freed by the Muslims and they remain non-Muslim, they don't have to pay jizya, and so on and so forth. So al-ahrar al-balighin, those who are above the age of puberty. وَلَا تُؤْخَذُ مِن نِسَائِهِمْ, it's not taken from their women folk. وَصِبْيَانِهِمْ, or from their children. وَعَبِيدِهِمْ, or from their slaves. وَتُؤْخَذُ مِنَ الْمَجُوسِ وَمِنَ النَّصَارَى. So this is another thing. People often think that this is something that's related to what's called the Ahlul Kitab, jizya, the people of the book. But no. What is specifically related to the Ahlul Kitab is marrying their women and eating their meat. As for jizya, or people who are dhimmi, they could be anything. They could be Majusi, they could be Hindu, they could be whatever it is. They would still be protected by paying the jizya. And they would be exempt from being taken prisoner or anything else. The dhimma means like a protection of the Muslims given to them. Yeah. So here he's making sure that we know that it can be taken from Majus, which is the people of Iran at the time. They were called Majians, fire worshippers. They used to have a holy fire that they had to keep alight the entire time. But they had other beliefs. I don't know much about it. I don't know if anybody does. And he says here, وَمِن نَصَارَ الْعَرَبِ, and from the Christian Arabs. In other words, it doesn't relate to whether a person is non-Arab. You might have to think that they were the people outside the lands of Arabia, because there was a special status, obviously, for the Arabs, because the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam was from them. So you might think, okay, that means that they're exempt. No. In fact, the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam said that there can be no two deens in the Hijaz and the Yemen. So, I mean, in other words, living there, not visiting. The Messenger of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam basically said that the areas where the Haramain are, and that extended beyond that a little bit, and the southern part of the Arabian Peninsula, should not have non-Muslims as residents in those areas. They were welcome as traders or for other visitors or whatever, or they were slaves who were freed. They might have some exemption. But specifically in the two harams, in fact, they were not allowed to be buried there. In fact, if you went to Saudi, maybe about 15 years ago, I went on Hajj in 2013, and there were signs on the road, non-Muslims must go this way and Muslims stay this way. I think those signs are not there anymore. They're still there. But now they've opened it up for non-Muslims. No, I'm talking, this was outside Medina, not outside Mecca.
Before that, it was not allowed to enter the
like Medina.
Yes, this was outside Medina when I was driving there.
Not entry for
non-Muslims. This was 2013, so only 11 years ago.
In Morocco, that's what in pages I was.
Yeah.
It was.
It used to be written in various places. But that was probably in the middle of Fez or something like that, yeah.
If you are aware, you were in Marrakesh.
I was in Marrakesh, yes.
I am from Casbah.
Yeah.
Casbah, there is a bigger mosque there.
Oh, so in the mosque itself. Yeah.
Yeah,
But this was not in the mosque. This was on the actual
outside.
motorway.
Outside of the mosque,
Yeah.
that's not,
Yeah.
but that was in 80s.
Yeah.
I was,
But if you look if you look in the books of
but
fiqh,
now it says,
if you look in the books of fiqh, this was a strong position. But anyway, it's not so much now.
no,
Yeah.
that's they talk
Yeah.
Arabic.
Wal jizyatu ala ahli dhahabi 4 denanir. So the people used to be divided up according to what they considered wealth. So some places would have gold as their main currency and silver as their secondary currency. Other places, they wouldn't even bother with gold much. Silver would be their main currency, and it would be a rarity for people to use gold. It's whatever is the money of the people of the land. This also indicates that when these sorts of things are collected, the first people that it should be given to are the people of the local place. Because if you're concentrating on getting the money that's used in a particular place, in fact, with zakat, as we're going to come to, that's one of the rules of zakat. You're not allowed to go beyond the locality unless there is extra need, and both extra need outside and all of the poor of the area that you're in have been taken care of already. That's the only time when you're allowed to go outside of that. But anyway, he says here it's 4 dinars a year for the people who use gold. 4 dinars is about 17 grams of gold.
Oh,
Yeah. So it's maybe a fifth of an ounce. So what is an ounce now? About 4,000 pounds? Something like that? Is a bit more than that, maybe. A bit more than that.
incredible.
Three and a half. So I mean it's not a huge amount anyway. This is per year. But this is, as I said, it's only for people who yeah, only for people who have the ability to afford it. Then he says here, "Wa ala ahli al-wariqi 40 dirham." It's 40 dinars for those people who use silver. 40 dirhams is very, very little now. It's like £100 or something. Very, very little. Maybe £150. But this was the what they all they had to pay. And as I said, they have to have the ability to pay. So if it was too much for them, in other words, if you took that from them, they would have to take out a loan. They wouldn't be able to look after their family or their basic needs. Then you can't take that from them. If you took 1 dirham from them when they were in a state that would put them in a state where they couldn't look after their own affairs, then you can't do that. وَيُخَفَّفُ عَنِ الْفَقِيرِ. So he says here, if somebody is poor, it is the amount that he has to pay is lessened, and until it reaches potentially zero. وَيُؤْخَذُ مِمَّا. So this is the second type. So this is jizya, but there, as I mentioned, there was also something called kharaj, which is a land tax that's not to do with people. And the interesting thing about kharaj is that if what you know they have to pay on their land, and then a Muslim buys that land from them. Because the zakat, the kharaj is due on the land, it still has to be paid even after the Muslim buys it. But the Muslim doesn't pay it. But if he grows crops on it, he has to pay zakat on his crops. But the kharaj has to still be paid on that land because it's owed to the Muslims from the land. So it's the person who sold it to him has to take that into consideration, but he still has to pay kharaj on that. The kharaj is the land tax, the amount that you have to pay on of crops that you grow on a particular land. And in those particular circumstances, the only way that it stops being paid is if he becomes Muslim. As soon as that person becomes Muslim, even if he sold it to a Muslim many, many years ago, that's it, and it doesn't get taken from anybody anymore. That's the way you remove kharaj. وَيُؤْخَذُ مِمَّا تَجِرَ مِنْهُمْ مِنْ أُفُقٍ إِلَى أُفُقٍ. So this is now a different thing. This is talking about traders and tariffs. Now, the Muslim lands used to be divided up into zones, trading zones, which were called iqlims. So, for example, the Arab Peninsula would have been one, Sham would have been another, Iraq, or the wider Iraq would have been another, Ifriqiya, which was like North Africa, would have been another, and then the Maghrib and Andalus would have been another. This was the classical zones that they divided the world into. So basically, non-Muslims who lived within the lands of Islam, they were the Dhimmis, they would live in one of these zones or other. Maybe they would be living in Sham, let's say, for example. Now, if this person from Sham wanted to trade in Iraq, or wanted to trade in the Arabian Peninsula, or wanted to trade in the Maghrib, he has to now pay the ushur, which is a tenth. He pays this tenth on what he sells. Not, he doesn't have to pay it on all his stock. So maybe he comes in, he goes, let's say, from Egypt to Libya, in which is part of what was called Ifriqiya. When he went to Libya, the moment he left Egypt, everything that he took with him to trade with, he would have to pay a tenth of what he sold of that. But he didn't have to pay anything until he sold it. Or if he took money and he bought stock in Libya and then sold that stock, he'd then have to pay of the, from the stock that he bought, or from the profit that he made potentially. But he pays once when he goes in or out. Maybe he comes in and out every month. He has to pay every time a tenth. If he stays for more than a year, he still only has to pay one tenth. Maybe he stays for 5 years in that iqlim. He only pays once, unlike the Muslim who pays zakat every year on his trading stock. So there can be benefits, but every time he goes from one iqlim to another, he has to pay this. So if he spends his time going between an iqlim, every time he leaves one iqlim and goes into a different iqlim trading zone, he has to pay this tenth, except in his own trading zone. So if his own trading zone was Sham, for example, if he traded in Sham, he would not pay anything, nothing. No zakat, no ushur, nothing in that particular zone. It's paid when he goes out of one zone into another. So if he lives, if he's from Sham and he travels from Ifriqiya to the Maghrib, he would have to pay in both those zones every time he goes between them, tenth each way, but not in his own one. That's the basic rules. These are for the Dhimmis, the people who live within the lands of Islam. So he says here, وَيُؤْخَذُ مِمَّنْ تَجِرَ, it is taken from those who trade of them, of the people of Dhimma, from أُفُق إِلَى أُفُق, and أُفُق is like a horizon, but it means here one zone to another zone. عُشْرُ ثَمَنِ مَا يَبِيعُونَ, a tenth of the price of what they pay, of what they sell. So it's only after they've sold something and the price they receive for selling it, they have to pay a tenth of that. Except in one place, which is Medina and Mecca. If you bring food into Medina and Mecca, you were given a special rate of nisful ushur, half a tenth, or 20th, because of the need of a place where don't grow much in the way of food for food to be brought in from outside. Which shows that the non-Muslims were allowed to enter these areas, but not allowed to live there.
Almost.
No, that's a nisful ushur, which is the 20th.
Yes.
Not doful ushur, which would be a hummus.
20.
Yeah, 1/20.
Um.
Even if they come in and out fisana mirara many times, they have to pay each time. وإن حملوا الطعام خاصة إلى مكة والمدينة خاصة, and if they bring in food, by food it means staples, by the way, like things like grain and things like that. If they bring in only food to Mecca and Medina only, those two zones, أُخِذَ مِنْهُمْ نِصْفُ الْعُشْرِ مِنْ ثَمَنِهِ. They are a 20th is taken from the price that they get for selling it. وَيُؤْخَذُ مِنْ تُجَّارِ الْحَرْبِيِّينَ. Now you have a different category, which are the non-Muslims from outside the lands of Islam, called the Harbiyin. If they come in, and they were often given a man, a safe passage to come into the lands of Islam, because trade is something that the Muslims would often need from people outside of their lands as well as within their lands. They would give people safe passage. And when they came in, these people, if you didn't mention any amount to them when they came in, By the way, the only person who can charge this is the take the jizya or charge the jizya is the leader of the Muslims. It can't be just you've got you're a little village leader and you know some non-Muslims come across, you say, no, I'm going to take it for my village from these non-Muslims. You're not allowed to do it. It's only actually the leader of the Muslims who's allowed to impose this. If you tell somebody you're going to be safe and I'll take from you, then they don't have to pay anything to you and they're safe. Because when a Muslim gives safety to somebody, it has to be taken into consideration, unless it goes against the interests of the Muslims. If you bring in somebody who is a spy and he's deliberately trying to destroy the lands of Islam from within, fifth column, then obviously then he wouldn't be given safety. But generally speaking, people are. So he says here, the Harbiyin, a tenth is taken from them as well when they come into the lands of Islam. So it's not nothing to do with Iqlims. The lands of Islam is considered to be one land now for the Harbiyin. That's if you don't say anything. But you could say, no, we're going to take a 20th, or we're going to take a fifth, or we're going to take half. I mean, if you make it's up, it's it, this is by an agreement now because they don't have any agreement with you. They're not people of dhimma. So you make an agreement the moment they come in. If you simply give them a man without mentioning any amount, that's when the tenth comes in that he mentions here. Illa an yanzilu ala akthar min dalik, says, except if they come in have agreeing to pay more than that. So these are the Harbiyin. Wa huwa dafnul jahiliyyah. Now he mentions something else, which he mentions in connection with the jizya, because this is something which is called, they often translate it as buried treasure, but it doesn't necessarily have to be buried. This is property that predates the entry of the Muslims into that land. In other words, if there is any indication there might be Muslim property, this rule would not apply. And if there's any indication that it's dhimmi property, people who've made a sulh with the Muslims, this rule will not apply. This is when a land is taken unwatan by force, all of the possessions of that land are what's called fey, which is something that the Muslims have a right to a fifth of. So basically, this is the general rule that he's talking about here, and this includes things that are buried under the ground. So if somebody finds treasure buried underground, outside the lands of Islam, or within the lands of Islam, and there is, it looks like it might predate the Muslim times there. Maybe it's, you know, Roman treasure, for example. Then he has a right. He has the right to that. That belongs to him if it is in unowned property, and he has to pay a fifth, which goes to the leader of the Muslims who distributes it among the poor of the Muslims, or to whatever maslaha is in the best interest of the Muslims. So this is how a lot of the income would have come in the past.
We found some money on the road, then it belonged to us or someone else.
Again, we are living in a land where we have a sort of ahd with the people. So it's almost like when you have an ahd with the people, you can't just take their property because you've made an agreement with them. So then that property that you find on the road, if there's an indication it belongs to somebody of this society, then you have to then use the rules of the laws of laqata, which is lost property, which he goes into more in greater detail. But the main one of that is you have to advertise it for a year. So you basically go into a mosque or a church or wherever it is and say, look, this has been found. And then you, in the place where it's been found or wherever you think it might be from, you have to make sure that people know about it and it's very public. But that's lost property. This is about buried treasure. So buried treasure, it belongs, except if you find it on somebody's land that belongs to that person. In which case, it's not yours, it belongs to the person who owns that land. Unless you make an agreement with the person who owns that land. You said you take you if you go and onto somebody's property and dig up their land and find some treasure without telling that guy, it's none of it's yours. But if you make an agreement with that guy beforehand saying, look, I want to come on your property and look for treasure, can we make an agreement that we're going to split it this way? Then yes. But if you do it without an agreement with him, you've gone to all that effort. And this is the other thing though, when there's a lot of effort when it comes to treasure, then the rules of zakat come into it, because then it's considered to be like a mine. When it's like a mine, because it takes a lot of effort, you only pay zakat, you don't pay the fifth. If it's not gold or silver, you don't pay anything if it's a lot of effort. Then you have the sea as well. What comes up from the sea is basically yours as well. The first person to get it, if it's clearly from the sea, like pearls or ambergris or the thing that, the things that come out of whales and things like that, all of these types of things, the valuable things from the sea. But again, sea is not owned by anybody. So then that's the person who finds it. And if you're a big group of us and we see something on the beach, say, oh, look at that. And it's whoever gets there first. It's his. Nobody else has a right to a portion of it, even though you've saw it first, because that's the from the sea. But that's a separate thing. If it's Rikaz treasure, then he says here, well, huwa dafn al-jahiliyyah, is what's been buried in the jahiliyyah, which means pre-Islam, but doesn't mean pre the Rasul sallallahu alaihi wasallam. It could be pre-Islam in any particular land. Al-khumus ala man asaba. He has to pay a he the person who finds it has to pay a fifth, and the rest of it is his. So that's the end of that particular section. If there are any questions on jizya and things like that, we're going to go on to this. This is a very simple, because this next one, none of us really have animals. Maybe you do in Morocco, I don't know. Maybe you have herds of sheep, herds of goats, but most of us don't. So we'll go through this quite quickly. He says, Babun fi zakat al-mashiyah, chapter relating to the zakat on livestock. He says here first, al-ibl. He says here, wa zakatul ibli wal baqari wal ghanami fariḍa. Zakat on ibil, which is camels, the plural of jamal, and the zakat on baqar, which is the singular and the plural of cow, and zakat on ghanam, which means goats and sheep. So it's a term which includes both of them, because they were considered basically almost cousins of each other. Those three things, is zakat on them is a fariḍah, is an obligation. If you have the threshold and they've been in your possession for the year. One thing that I should make clear, when it comes to livestock and when it comes to crops, it's not the same as money. With money, you don't have somebody who comes and assesses and check, who comes and collects from you. Basically, it's up to you, because it's hidden, mainly hidden wealth. That doesn't mean it's your choice to pay it. They still, if you acknowledge it, he can take it from you. Because Sayyidina Umar radiallahu anhu said, Khudh min kulli arba'ina dinaran, min kulli arba'ina dirhaman dirhama. Take from every 40 dirhams a dirham. So that's still khudh. Khudh min amwalihim sadaqa. You don't have a choice about it. It's a fariḍah. And it's still something that the people of authority can take. But they did not send collectors, which were called sa'is or musaddiqs. But these people would come, they would assess. For an example, is Khaybar. Khaybar belonged to the Jews. This wasn't for zakat, because this was assessing how much of the tribute the Jews had to pay. But the assessors would come and they would look at what was on the trees after they'd ripened, and they would do what's called kharz, and they would work out exactly how much dates were going to be harvested. And by dates, I mean tamar, which is after they've been dried. How much tamar would come from what was on the trees? And the reason why they did it this way, and they didn't wait for it until it had all been, because people would often eat after that point. I mean, for example, the people of Khaybar were well known for liking to eat what's called rutab, dates at that particular stage when they're soft, but before they've dried. And so, yeah, well, that's pre-rutab. So they have these various different stages. So basically, they would assess it before anything was picked, but after it was ripe, because they knew that people would then eat from it, or maybe they would give some away at that previous stage. And then when you actually come to measure the full amount of tamar, it would be less than was actually on the trees. And then the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam would, with the person he would send, would say, well, either you accept it at this, basically. Or you pay based on particular other thing. There was a hadith where it talks about they would be told, if you must accept our thing, or you have to then keep them all and measure them, basically. So they would accept, because they like to eat them before that point. So basically, this is, and it was the same with mashia, which is what we're talking about here with livestock. So the sa'i would come, and he would come usually at one point in the year where all of the animals were gathered around the drinking holes. because people would then take their whole herds to, they often didn't have much water in the places where they were, would generally eat. So they would, when there was plentiful water, they would bring all of their animals to a particular place where there was lots of water. And everybody's animals will all be in the same sort of area. So for it to be easy, the leader of the Muslims would send his collectors to assess the animals then. But obviously, this is only once every solar year, not lunar year. So it meant that actually the zakat for animals was actually every, in effect, every solar year rather than every lunar year. Solar year. So if you think about Ramadan, Ramadan changes every year, doesn't it? It's 1 year it's in summer, then it moves backwards until it becomes in spring. So the actual year that zakat is due on is shorter than what's called the solar year, which is the years that we use now. But with zakat al-mashiyah, they would take into account the season, and they would always come in the same season, which meant that they would come after the lunar year had finished, maybe 2 weeks later sometimes. And in fact, over a period of time, this could work out quite a lot. I mean, every 30 years, you would gain a year or whatever it is. This is if there are collectors. But obviously now, most of the governments don't send out collectors. So people have to assess it themselves. And obviously then you have another calculation. Is the government trustworthy to give zakat to the people or not? If you make the assessment that the government, I'm talking about in Muslim countries, but here we actually do have a system because none of us has that type of wealth where we have an emir who's very trustworthy and he takes it and he makes sure it goes to the right people. But in a place where you can't be sure if the government's going to use it for their nuclear program or whatever, anything else, they're not going to give it to the poor, then you have to make that assessment. And if you think that they're not, then you have to distribute them yourself, and you have to do that on the lunar year. You don't wait until the season if you're doing it yourself. You have to do it properly based upon the year, which is the hawl, which is the lunar year. It's only when there is a collector that you take into account the solar year. That's just something that's separate from this. He says, "Wala zakata min al-ibil fi aqalli min 50 dhud or dhoud." There is no zakat on camels when a person has less than 5 camels. It's important to know, as we're going to come to later, by the way, when he says camel, 5 camels, it includes camels of any age. If you have 5 baby camels and that's all you have, you're considered to have 5 camels. You have 5 spring lambs, who've all just been born and nothing else, you're considered to have 5 spring lambs. There's no zakat on 5 spring lambs, but I'm just saying that it counts, any animal that you have counts of that particular type. Well, here, khamsun min al-ibil. So he says the word dhawud here means 5 camels. Fafiha shah jada'a aw thaniya. These two words here, jada'a and thaniya, they both mean the same thing, basically. They are referring to a sheep or a goat, as he's going to come to, that has reached the age where its adult teeth are appearing. So, I mean, even like a lot of mammals, they have children teeth that fall out and then they are replaced by, and that's when they've reached an age. This is about a year old, usually, I think, the sheep.
One.
It depends on the breed, but about a year.
Like in
So it could be 6 months
yeah, 6
sometimes,
months,
but
and for the goat, 1 year.
yeah.
Yeah, one.
But this is what's called a thaniya or a jada. Yeah, but that's not the word. This word is not being used in that way here. Yeah, it's actually simply referring to that particular. Yeah. So basically, that's when they're about a year old. This refers to sheep and goats. They're quite similar, but it depends on the breed. So you have 5 camels, you have to pay a sheep. Well, if you don't have sheep, then you have to buy it. Yeah.
Have to pay that amount.
And it's not your choice, by the way. So if he comes and you have 5 camels and you also have a herd of sheep and a herd of goats, it's up to the musaddiq, the collector. He says, okay, I think I want to take a goat. Then he can take a goat. Or I want to take a sheep. He can take a sheep. It's up to him. But he can't take the best of your stock or the worst of your stock. He takes what's in the middle. Because he has to take into account the needs of the poor and your need as a farmer. So he takes what's in the wasat. فَفِيهَا شَاتٌ جَبْعَةٌ أَوْ ثَنِيَّةٌ مِنْ جُلِّ غَنَمِ أَهْلِ ذَلِكَ الْبَلَدِ. So he says here, what he should do is take into account the main sort of ghanam that's in that particular land, the main sheep. So if it's a land where people tend to eat goats or tend to have goats for their milk or whatever it is, and somebody has five camels, then he should take a goat, even if you've got sheep as well, basically. He says here, min batnin o ma'iz. So batn is sheep, ma'iz is goats. Ila tisa. So there's one unique thing here with animals that's different from the other forms of zakat. If I have 20 dinars, that's when my zakat starts. Then if I have 21 dinars or 22 dinars, then my zakat is on all of the 22 dinars. I take a 40th of all of them. If I have crops, if I have five awqiyas, then I pay on that. If I have six awqiya, then I pay on that, all six. But with camels, if I have five camels, or I have six camels, or I have seven camels, or I have eight camels, or I have nine camels, I just pay on one sheep. And I don't pay one sheep and a little bit because I've got an extra camel. No, it's just one sheep. That's called a waqas. It's called zakat levels or quotas or different levels that you jumps. With sheep, it's quite a big one. It goes, if I have 40 sheep, I pay one sheep. If I have 120 sheep, I pay one sheep.
Like minimum 40 and more than, and
Yeah.
just
Yeah.
continue.
Thumma fil ashri shatan ila arba'ati ashra. Then he says here, when you have between 10 and 14 camels, you pay two sheep or two goats. Thumma fi khamsati ashar, thalathati shiyah ila tis'ati ashar. Then between 15 and 19, you pay three sheep or three goats. Fa'idha kanat ishreen fa arba'a shiyah. If you've got 20, he says here, ila arba'atin wa ishreen, up to 24, 21 or 22, 23 or 24, you pay four sheep or four goats. So this is up to 24. As soon as you have more than 24, the conversation changes. He says here, "Thumma fi khamsin wa ishrina bintu makhab." Then, when you have 25 camels, you have to give what's called a bintu makhab. This is a female camel whose mother is pregnant. What does that mean? It means between 1 and 2 years old. Because basically, what happens with camels is the pregnancy is about a year. Then they nurse the animal or feed the milk, give the animal milk for a year, and then they're pregnant again. So this first animal now is under the mother who's now pregnant with the next one. So it's called a bint machab. That's why it's called a bint machad, because machab means pregnant. So basically, it means a female camel that's between 1 and 2 years old. If you don't have them again, then you have to sell or what you have in order to buy it or whatever it is. But usually, if you have 25 camels, you're likely to have one.
Happened nearly to before.
Yeah. He says here, then he says here, Wahia bintu sanatain. It is a daughter that is in the second year here, rather than actually being fully 2 years old. It's within its second year. If you don't have one of those, if you don't have a bintu makhad, which is a female camel between 1 and 2, then you have to give an ibnu labun. An ibn, meaning a male son, a male camel whose mother is a labun, giving the milk, which means 1 year older, giving a milk to the next one. Not giving the milk to you, because if you're giving the milk to that one, then you're still considered a calf, and there's no zakat. They can't be given a zakat. So this means between 2 and 3 years old, the mother is giving milk to the next baby. Thumma fi sittin wa thalathina bintu labun. So if you have 26 or 27 or 28 or 29 or 20 or 30 or 31 or 32. There or 33, then that's all you give. Either this or that, the bint machad or the ibn labun. A male camel of between 2 and 3 years, or a female camel of between 1 and 2. As soon as you get up to sittun 36, then you give a bint labun, a female camel whose mother is breastfeeding the next one. So
For
between 2 and 3. Wahiya bintu thalath sinin. It is a child that's 3 years. Ila khamsin wa arba'in. That is up to 45 camels. Thumma fi sittin wa arba'ina hiqqa. Then the next one here is what's called a hiqqa. When you reach 46 camels, you have to give what's called a hiqqa, which is another year older.
Come.
Yeah. So basically, this is when it's basically becoming an adolescent, a hiqqa, basically almost reaching adulthood. You can basically put loads on the camel and use it. Whereas before that, you shouldn't be putting any loads on the camels or any or riding camels under that age. When it's a hiqqa, it's from the word to istahaqqa, to be deserving, but in a sense, it means it's ready. It's ready to be to be used, but it's not fully adult yet, but it's ready to be given extra responsibilities. So that's a hiqqa. وهي التي يصلح على ظهره الحمل. It is the one that it can bear loads. ويطرقها الفحل, and it can actually be the male stud camel can actually come to that camel. You know, a stud camel, a stud in is the basically, so you usually have like a big load of female sheep or female camels or female cows, and you have like a bull, or you have a billy goat or whatever it is. That's here what's called the fahl. And so this with camels, he's saying this hiqqa is old enough to be visited by the fahl. Wahiya bintu 4 sinin ila 60. And that's the one that's 4 years old. He says until 60. So between 46 and 60, that's what you give, one hiqqa. He says here, thumma fi ihda wa 60 jada'a. Then when you come to 61, you give a jada'a, which is a bintu khamsi sinin, which is now a 5-year-old camel. So basically the fully adult camel now. Jada'a again is the same one when its adult teeth have fully come through, basically. So it's the same word is used for sheep when they're 1 year old, or camels when they're 5 years old. That gives you some difference in the length of time that an animal remains a calf or a lamb. He says, well, here, ila khamsin wa sab'een. This is up to 75. Then here, thumma fi sittin wa sab'een binta labun ila tis'een. Then you go back now, because you're not giving any camels older than this now. Although it's permitted. If you give one that's better, out from your own free will. So say I had 46 and I gave a jada'ah. That's fine. If I decide to do it, but the collector can't take it from me. The maximum he can take from me is the ones mentioned here. He can't say, no, I'm taking your, for example, they have these camels where they race on. Maybe it's a very expensive camel. He can't say, no, I'm going to take that one. It's like worth 1 million in Emirates or whatever it is. He has to choose the middle one that fits the things that we mentioned. So he says here, when you get to now 76 to 90, you have two binta labuns of the 2 to 3 year old ones, the daughters of the mother that's feeding the next ones. Thumma fi ihda wa tis'een hiqqatan ila 20 wa 100. Then between 91 and 120, so it's quite a big gap this here, 91 to 120. And it's important to try and remember these gaps, because sometimes people put their flocks together, as we're going to mention later, in order to avoid zakat. Or to. So the example he gives, for example, if I've got 40 sheep, I have to pay one sheep. If you have 40 sheep, you have to pay one sheep. And if you have 40 sheep, one sheep. Yeah. So we each have to pay one sheep each. So if we become Khalid, we combine all of our things, that we have one shepherd, We have them all rest in the same place. They are all eating the same food and drinking the same water and so on and so forth. Then between us, we have to pay one sheep, 120. So the situation, as he's going to mention, is what often would happen is that 1 week before they knew pretty much when he was coming. So they would say, well, okay, let's combine all of our flocks together. And if he found out about that, then he would just ignore it. And he'd take three from you anyway. But if he didn't find out about it, or you gave him a valid reason and you were an upstanding fellow, why you did it not just to avoid zakat, then you would pay just one between you. So it would be taken from, say, from my 40. Then I would go back to the two of you and say, right, I want you to give me your the third that you owe me. You give it as money. You give me the third you owe me. But anyway, it says here between 91 and 120, it's two hiqqas, which was the 4 to 5 year olds, the 3 to 4 year olds, sorry, the ones that are up to four. فَمَا زَادَ عَلَى ذَلِكَ فَفِي كُلِّ 50 حِقَّةٍ وَفِي كُلِّ 40 بِنْتْ لَبُونَ. Above this, so anything above 120, say you have 121, then he says here, in every 50, it is a hiqqa, the slightly younger ones, or the slightly older ones, the 3 to 4 year olds, and in every 40, it's a bint laboon, which is the 2 to 3 year olds. But this is actually makes a bit of a difference of opinion here, because if I have 121, he's just said here anything above 120. So if I have 121, that's 3 lots of 40. Yeah. So 3 lots of 40 means 3 bint laboons, yeah? But he's just said that up to 120 is 2 hiqqas. So what do I do at 121? Does he have the choice between two of the one or three of the other? Or does he simply mean until you get to 130, this kicks in? So there's a difference of opinion about that. Because if I have 121 or 122, he could take three or two. I wouldn't know which one he's going to take. But if you, based upon the people who say, I think Ibn al-Qasim was one, that he has the choice from above 120, he could choose to take the three younger ones or the two older ones. It would be his choice. But if you get to 130, he doesn't have that choice. Because 130 is just 2 lots of 40 and 1 lot of 50. You can't have 3 lots of 40 because there's 10 left over. So then it would be obviously one of the older ones and two of the younger ones in that particular situation. So when you get to 200, then he has a choice. Because 200 is 5 or 4. And the choice is up, is not up to you.
It's up to the
It's up to the collective. وَلَا زَكَاةَ مِنَ الْبَقَرِ فِي أَقَلِّ مِنْ 30. As for cows, there is no zakat if you have less than 30 cows. Yes. He says here, فَإِذَا بَلَغَتْهَا, if it reaches 30, if you have 30 cows, فَفِيهَا تَبِيعٌ. He says here, it's an ijlun jada qad awfa sanatain. So a tabi' is a 2 year old, one that's reached 2 years old, male bull, well, calf. He says ijl, but it's a jada again. So it's an adult. It's had its adult teeth through. It's 2 years old. And it has to be a male. It has to be a male. So again, if you don't have males, then you have to. But I mean, usually if somebody has 30, they will likely to have a male. Thumma kadhalika hatta tablugha 40, then it remains that until it reaches 40. So if you have 39, it's still just one tabi', 1 2-year-old male. Fayakunu fiha musinna. At that point, you have to give what's called a musinna, which is a female cow. He says here, وَلَا تُؤْخَذُ إِلَّا أُنْثَى. You can't take anything but a female at this point. وَهِيَ بِنْتُ 4 سِنِينَ. And it is a one that is now in its 4th year. So it's 1 year older than the male. And it is what's called a musinna. وَهِيَ ثَنِيَّ. So it's talking about, again, it's to do with the teeth. 40. So basically with cows, there's only two things. Either at 30, you give a male bull that's 2 years old or more. And at 40, you give a female cow that's minimum of 3 years old. Then it goes up in tens after that. So he says here, فما زاد ففي كل أربعين مسنة وفي كل ثلاثين تبيئة. So basically, at this point, if you go up, you get to 50, still there's the same, it's the same. When you get to 60, you now have two lots of 30. When you get to 70, you have one lot of 30, one lot of 40. When you get to 80, two lots of 40. When you get to 90, three lots of 30. So basically, between 40 and 60, it remains the same, or 59. Is that clear? زكاة في الغنم حتى تبلغ 40. لا زكاة في الغنم حتى تبلغ 40 شاة. There is no zakat on goats or sheep until they reach 40. فإذا بلغتها ففيها شاة جذعة أو ثنية. When they reach that point, you have to give a sheep that's 1 year old, basically. A 1 year old sheep, one that's reached its adulthood. The end of the lamb phase. إلى 20 ومئة. This continues all the way up to 120, as I said. So it's a big lot. You can have 120 sheep and still only pay one sheep. فإذا بلغت إحدى وعشرين ومئة ففيها شاتان. If you have 121, though, you have to give two sheep. إلى مئتي شاة. So until you have 200. No, 200 is still two sheep. 121 to 200 is two sheep. فإذا زادت واحدة, if you have one more than that, 201. ففيها ثلاث شياه. You have to pay three sheep. As I said, I'm just mentioning sheep to make it easier. This is sheep or goats. إلى ثلاثة مئة. Up to 300. Then it goes to 301. Then it's the next one. He says, فَمَا زَادَ فَفِي كُلِّ مِئَةِ شَاهِ. So he says here, okay, up after that, when you get to 400, then there's an extra one on each 100 after that. So the earlier bits is when you reach 201, 301, but the later on it's when you have exactly 400, when you have exactly 500. One. So basically, when you have 400. So he says here, فَمَا زَادَتْ وَاحِدًا فَفِيهَا ثَلَاثَ شِيَاهٍ إِلَّا ثَلَاثَةِ مِئَةٍ until you reach 300. He says here, فَمَا زَادَ فَفِي كُلِّ مِئَةٍ شَاةٍ. So that means 399 is still three sheep. It's only when you get to 400 that four sheep.
401,
five. No, 401, still four sheep. 500, five sheep. Yeah. وَلَا زَكَاةَ فِي الْأَوْقَاسِ. You don't have to pay any zakat on the extra sheep that you have between each category. So 40 is the same as 120. وَهِيَ مَا بَيْنَ الْفَرِيضَتَيْنِ. That's the waqas, is what's between the two zakat levels. مِنْ كُلِّ الْأَنْعَامِ. Of all the different categories of livestock. وَيَجْمَعُ الدَّأْنُ وَالْمَعِزِ فِي الزَّكَاةِ. If you have two flocks, one of sheep and one of goats, you add them together. So if you have 20 sheep and 20 goats, you give one. Now, which one does he take? Again, it's up to the collector. If you have 20, it's up to him. Even if you have, say, 30 sheep and 10 goats, it's still up to him. It's still up. Obviously, if you have 39 sheep and one goat, he will, yeah. Because I mean, there has to be some level, but it also depends on what is the main animal of the area that you're in, of that particular one. He says here, will jawamis wal baqar. You also combine buffalo, which was often what they used in Egypt, I think, was the main cow they had in Egypt. And cows, I don't know about things like yaks. They might be considered breeds of cow. I don't know. But anything that's sort of like a relative of within what's known of as cow or within what's known as buffalo, they're combined. And then he says, wal bukht wal irab. Now, bukht is what's called a Bactrian camel. Now, I don't know if you've seen in Asia, like Central Asia, they have these very hairy looking camels that have two humps. They're quite short often. Yeah. The Mongolians would use them. They're called the Bactrian camel. And then you have the Arab, which is the what's called the dromedary, which are the really tall, really high, very thin legged camels that have one hump. He says it doesn't matter which, they combined. They're both zakat is on both. So if you have four of one and one of the other, generally speaking, if you have, say, you're paying two camels and you have an equal amount, it would take one camel of each type. But then when you had a third camel, it would be up to, say, he was paying three and you have equal, then he would choose which one he wanted to take, whatever was in the best interest of the fuqara usually. وَكُلُّ خَلِيتَيْن فَإِنَّهُمَا يَتَرَادَّانِ بَيْنَهُمَا بِسَوِيَّةٍ. If you are mixing your flock with somebody else, as I said, people often used to do that. For example, they would have one shepherd maybe in a village, and he would go out and he would look after the flocks of the entire village. And they would take them to the same places to eat. They would take them to the same places to drink. Maybe to save money, they would all sleep at the same place in the night. Maybe they would even share a fahl, the animal that. So if you share all of those things, you're considered to be khalid. So basically, when a person is khalid, the collector only takes into account the flock, not the individuals. It's considered to be one flock for his purpose. So if he comes and finds 120 sheep, as I said, he can only take one sheep. He can't say, "Oh, you own 40, you own 40, you own 40." So that's three. No. He has to view it as a, that's what he's talking about here. So this would often be, as I said, it would often be many, many people, but he talks about here with two people because this was the easiest one to deal with. So basically, if he comes and he takes the one sheep, 120 sheep, and you have one person has 40 sheep and the other person has 80 sheep, he can only take one. So how do you work out how much each person has to pay back the other one? Who does who, first, whose flock does he take it from? He doesn't know. He just takes whichever sheep he sees, basically, because he's treating it as one flock. So he might take it from the person who has 80, or he might take it from the person who has 40. If he takes it from the person who has 40, then the person who has 40 then goes to the other one and says, "Look, give me back 2/3 of the value of the sheep." If he takes it from the person who has the 80, then he goes to the other one and says, "No, give me back 1/3 of the value of my sheep, of a sheep." That's the way it works, basically. If one of them has 30 and the other one has 50, let's say, still only one sheep, then the zakat is taken from the person who has the 50 sheep. And if he takes it from the wrong one, he has to give him back a whole sheep, because you can't charge zakat on somebody who's not above the level of zakat on his own. So even if their level was huge, say he came and found a flock of 500 sheep, and it was between 20 people. If he couldn't take any zakat on that flock of 500 sheep, if the people claimed to him that it was owned by nobody had the level of zakat. So he still has to, he can't just go to a flock and take. He has to actually speak to the people involved as well. وَلَا زَكَاةَ عَلَى مَنْ لَمْ تَبْلُغْ حِصَّتُهُ عَدَدَ الزَّكَاةِ. So there's no zakat on the one whose share of the flock doesn't reach the level of zakat. ولا يفرق بين مجتمع ولا تجمع بين مفترق. This is a hadith of the Rasul صلى الله عليه وسلم. لا يجمع بين متفرق ولا يفرق بين مجتمع خشية الزكاة أو خشية الصدقة. He says here, this is what I was talking about before. You can't separate your flock when you know that the collector's on his way in order to pay less zakat, or bring the flock back together in order to pay less zakat. So, for example, let's say both of you have 100 sheep, and you've been together the entire time. You've been mixed, you've used, you're sharing your resources, and then you hear that the musaddiq is coming, the collector, and you think, "Oh my gosh! If he comes, we'll have to pay three sheep because we're 200 sheep here. But if we separate, we'll only have to pay one sheep each." So then you decide to separate them quickly before he comes in order to pay less. If you do that, as he mentions here, he says, وَذَٰلِكَ إِذَا قَرُبُ الْحَوْلُ. That's when the hawl, the year, is approaching. فَإِذَا كَانَ يَنْقُسُ أَدَاؤُهُمَا بِافْتِرَاقِهِمَا أَوْ بِاجْتِمَاعِهِمَا أُخِذَ بِمَا كَانَ عَلَيْهِ قَبْلَ ذَٰلِكَ. If the amount they have to pay is lessened by them separating the flock, or adding the flock together, then you take the collector takes from them as if they hadn't done that, basically. He takes it as if they were still together. This actually happens a lot more than people realize. People try tricks to evade zakat, but if it is clear that they have tried to evade zakat, those tricks don't help them in the law, because zakat evasion was a thing not just with animals, but it was also sometimes you might give a gift to somebody quickly, or a loan to somebody, which was clearly in that particular case for no other purpose than the avoidance of zakat. Or for example, there's one they mentioned in the Mudawwana where somebody has camels, and he sells the camels for sheep just before the Musaddiq has come. In that case, he doesn't have to pay zakat, because then he hasn't had the sheep for a full year. But if the next year he then sells those sheep for camels, then he would have to pay zakat, because he's obviously doing that simply to avoid zakat. He'd be let off one time. If he sold it for money, he'd have to pay for Peter. He would have to pay zakat. That's different. I'm just quickly going to do one last bit here just to finish this. وَلَا تُؤْخَذُ مِنَ الصَّدَقَةِ فِي الصَّدَقَةِ السَّخْلَةِ. You cannot take a spring lamb. The collector cannot take an animal that is below the age that we've mentioned of any of these things. It can't be below 1 year old for, well, it's not exactly 1 year old, as I said. Sometimes, because it's the same laws that come when you do the sacrifice. They have to reach that level where they are of a particular age, where their adult teeth have come through. With some breeds, that could be 10 months.
Like sometimes it looks like at that age,
Yeah,
but
but it's very rarely less than 9 or 10 months. Very rarely for sheep. And for the other breeds, it'd be very rarely less than 2 years old for a cow. Very rarely, and for camels to reach that stage that we're talking about. With camels, it's quite clear, because it's to do with the process of pregnancy. But anyway, you're not allowed to take a sakhla, which is a young baby sheep or a young baby goat, a lamb, or a kid. وَتُعَدُّ عَلَىٰ رَبِّ الْغَنَمِ. But they are considered to be counted when it comes to counting the number of heads of cattle or heads of sheep that a person has, for the purpose of saying whether they have to pay zakat. So if I had 20 sheep, and then the zakat collector came, found me with 20 sheep, and then he came back the next year, and I had 20 sheep, and they'd just given birth in the course of that year to 20 lambs, I'd have to pay zakat, because I've got 40 now, and those 20 were considered to be already in some ways present in the eyes of the male sheep, at least, the previous year. وَلَا تُؤْخَذُ الْعَجَاجِيلُ. An ijl is a baby cow. They cannot be taken fil baqar, وَلَا الْفُصْلَانُ, nor a fasil, which is a camel under the age of one, fil ibil, وَتُعَدُّ عَلَيْهِمْ. But they are considered to count in terms of the head count of how many livestock you have. وَلَا تُؤْخَذُ تَيْسُ. You cannot take a tais, which is it's like an older bull that is a fahl, basically a stud animal. Or tais is for a goat. It's called a, it's like well, I mean it's like a billy goat. That's a billy goat, I think they call them.
Really,
I think, yeah, but it's usually one that's for breeding. It's what's called a billy goat. But generally speaking, anyway, with sheep, you don't take males generally with sheep anyway. Sheep and goats, you don't take males. Cows, yes, and sometimes camels. Wala harma, which is an old and decrepit that's starting to, become sinewy and very, very thin. وَلَلْمَاخِضِ, nor a pregnant animal. وَلَا فَحْلٌ, nor an animal, فَحْلَ الْغَنَمِ, nor a sheep that's a ram, that's for the purpose of breeding. وَلَا شَاةُ الْعَلَفِ, nor a sheep that is being fattened up in order to be sold for meat. So it's alaf, which is fodder, sheep that's basically being given lots of fodder. والتي تربي ولدها nor any of these animals that are looking after their young. So when they are nursing their young, when they are laboon, when they are giving milk to their young, they can't be taken. وَلَا خِيَارِ أَمْوَالِ النَّاسِ وَلَا خِيَارَ أَمْوَالِ النَّاسِ nor the best of a person's flock or a person's animals. So you can't just go and you find, you say, wow, that one's really nice. I'll take that one. He says, وَلَا شِرَارَ. He doesn't mention it here, but ignore nor the worst. Because you've got to take into account the people who are going to be receiving the zakat. وَلَا يُؤْخَذُ فِي ذَلِكَ عَرْضٌ وَلَا ثَمَنٌ. You cannot take a non-cash equivalent for your sheep. وَلَا ثَمَنٌ nor a cash equivalent, although there is a bit of actually leeway when they cash it with a cash. A cash value. He says, no, not they're very strict with non-cash. You can sometimes they will allow you if you cannot find another sheep to pay or anything, then he can take a cash equivalent that is equal in value to what would have to be paid. But that's disliked.
Yeah, but
that's makruh, makruh. But with non-cash, say somebody wants to give a jewel or they want to give, I don't know, some thobe, you know, some cloth or something like that, that's not allowed.
But it's camel in camels.
No, not even with camels, with none of them. He says here, فَإِنْ أَجْبَرَهُ الْمُصَدِّقُ عَلَى أَخْذِ الثَّمَنِ If the collector forces him to by taking cash, to give him cash, he says here, فِي الْأَنْعَامِ وَغَيْرِهَا أَجْزَأَهُ Whether it's in livestock or something else, in other words, crops, he says that that is enough. So basically, if you are forced by the collector to give it that way, then you have to do what you have to do. But otherwise, you should not be, because we don't have collectors now. We have if we have animals, we give animals. If we have crops, we give crops. If we have ayn, we give ayn. Although we don't actually, as I said before, nobody's paying in gold and silver anymore. Because zakat is only the proof that zakat is on gold and silver and not money, is that if you have a gold bar that has not been minted into money, you have to pay zakat on it. And with the Hanafis, if you have jewelry that's gold and silver, you have to pay zakat on it. Not with us. Alhamdulillah. Imam Malik. Unless you're a man. If you're a man who owns gold jewelry, you have to pay zakat on it because you shouldn't be owning it. Yes.
Yeah.
Basically, the position of Malik is if you buy jewelry in order to use it once in your lifetime, say it's wedding jewelry. So you wear it once on your wedding and never wear it again. That's enough to exempt it from zakat.
Only one time?
If you buy it in order to hire it out, say you have a jewelry hiring out business, you don't pay zakat. Because you're hiring it in order to own it. You're not hiring it as money or as a store of wealth. Even though there is a secondary intention, often with gold and silver, to store your wealth. But it's not the only intention. That's the thing. He's very lenient. If there is any intention of it being your possession, then you don't pay zakat. I mean, like, for example, you have an expensive painting in the modern world, or a first edition comic book, or a first edition of Dickens or something, whatever. That you wouldn't have to pay zakat on it, even though it's a store of wealth. Some store of wealth.
If somebody is waiting what you then.
Even if they have, you know, a ridiculous amount of jewelry, but they wear it, even if it's only once in their lifetime. If somebody buys jewelry and just immediately keeps it in its packet and stores it away, then that's different, because they're not wearing that in order to own it at all. They're simply wearing it in order to keep their money safe. Then there would be zakat on that. But if you have any intention of wearing it at all, even if it's only once, a lot with these wedding jewelry, isn't it? They wear it just on the wedding. That's it. Never again.
In our country, mostly people like have jewelry to wear, like one before the period.
Yeah.
So you have to pay that. Yeah. Have specific amount.
Yeah. Yeah. But as I said, that's a proof that zakat is on gold and silver and not on money per se. The other proof is that Imam Malik said that there's no zakat on what's called flus. Do you know what flus is? The modern day word for money is flus. But flus referred to what's called a fils. And a fils was like a copper coin or a nickel coin, or because there were many things that, silver is too much. If you're buying a loaf of bread, having a silver coin was overkill. So if you wanted to buy a loaf of bread, you needed a smaller denomination of coin. So they have what's called fils. But this didn't was not considered to have any real value to it. It was something that was just used for the small transactions. And sometimes the value of it would completely disappear overnight. I mean, it mentions in the Mudawwana, for example, if I lend you 1,000 fils, and then that fils becomes worthless, I still only have to pay you that 1,000 fils. I don't have to give you the same equivalent value. So, I mean, it's a. But there's no zakat on it, according to Malik. He considered it more closer to be like trading goods in a sense. So it's not on money. So this is a problem we have in the modern world where nobody uses gold and silver anymore. So this is why we have to actually think very carefully about this currency and how we can actually restore a currency that has real worth. Because otherwise, how can you do zakat? Something we have to think about. Anyway, just one last bit here. وَلَا يُسْقِطُ الدَّيْنُ زَكَاةَ حَبٍّ وَلَا تَمْرٍ وَلَا مَاشِيَةٍ. If you have a debt, we mentioned before that if you have debts and you owe people money, and then you have to pay zakat on money, that debt can stop you having to pay zakat. Not always, because you have to take into account the rest of your possessions and whether they can offset the debt or not, but it can stop your zakat on money. But if you have crops and you have a huge debt, say I owe you 1,000 dinars, and I have 10 camels. The fact that I owe you 1,000 dinars does not stop me having to pay my two sheep. I still have to pay them. Or if I have an orchard of dates, I would still have to pay the zakat on the dates, even though I owe you 1,000 dinars. Wouldn't stop it.
What is like some people are saying they don't like to pay the debts, but they already have way too much debts.
How do you,
So like for example, you have some debts with some people, you already have enough money to pay the debts, but you don't like to clear
So
the
yeah, if the debt is due, and it's proven that you have money, then what would ha usually happen was that you would be often put in prison.
That's in somewhere in the
This was
vicinity.
called debtor's prison. They wouldn't put you in prison if you didn't have the means to pay. Because if you don't have the means to pay, then you still need to do some work in order to get the means. But if you have the money and you're simply refusing to pay,
That's a problem.
then yes, there would be punishments attached to not doing that. If it is clear from the qara'in lahwal, from the circumstances, that you actually do have the money, or you admit to have the money, you just say, "Yeah, I've got the money, but I'm just not giving it to you because I don't like you."
That's in someone can you tell me if you have to pay second until you pay the
I spoke about this a lot more detail last week. I'll just quickly mention it again, just for the people who are here. If I owe you 1,000 dinars, but I have a mansion and I have a fleet of Ferraris, for example, and if I sell those things and then I buy myself a cheaper house and a cheaper car, I wouldn't have that debt anymore. That would be enough to pay off the debt. Then that debt is ignored. I don't have to sell the house and the Ferraris. It's just that you do that calculation, whether what I have is enough to offset that debt. If it is, then it does not reduce my need to pay zakat. So if I own 1,000, if I have 1,000 dinars in cash, I've had them for a year, and I also owe you 1,000 dinars, that does not automatically mean I don't pay.
I have to pay.
You have to pay if your rest of your assets that are not essential to you or your dependents can offset that debt. It's an important realization. A lot of people don't realize that. Anyway, we'll finish there, inshallah. بسم الله وبركاته بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين الرحمن الرحيم مالك يوم الدين إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين آمين اللهم صل على سيدنا محمد عبدك ورسولك النبي الأمي وعلى آله وصحبه وسلم تسليما سبحان ربك رب العزة ما يصفون وسلام على المرسلين والحمد لله رب العالمين. We'll finish this section next time, inshallah. I mean, we have to talk about the masarif, which he doesn't mention in the Risala, which are the people who receive zakat.
So much. That's all. We're continuing in Zakat
إن شاء الله.
next.